Crime Fiends. Beaming liberty into your brain. Spreading it all across the universe. This is Derek J here with you live tonight, broadcasting from Keene in the Shire. And across the tubes with me is Bill. Hey, Bill.
Hey, this is Bill Buper, philosophically terraforming the planet one disobedient surf at a time with my great friend and the mellifluous speaker, he himself, Derek J.
Oh, you're so sweet. Hey, so we're here tonight to talk about freedom, because we are both obsessed with freedom. All day I think about it. When I wake up, freedom. When I go to sleep, freedom.
We both suffer from opposition defiance disorder.
Is that true?
And I wear it proudly.
I don't know. Now I'm skeptical. I don't know if I can believe that claim. I want to challenge it. Is that what it's about? Oppositional defiance disorder. Well, hey, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on tonight. I want to talk about there are some marriage issues going on in
Michael's
Idaho.
What about Michael's location? Aren't we concerned about Michael's location?
Who's Michael? Michael Dean. Michael Dean. Regular host of the Freedom Fiends, right?
I happen to know where he is.
What's he doing tonight?
He is at a charter membership fundraising event for male breast cancer in Colorado.
Oh, he's so kind.
What he's trying to do is raise, apparently, there's a connection between marijuana usage that's rather heavy and gynecomastia, which is male breasts.
What a generous man. Well,
I think he is.
Unfortunately, he couldn't be with us tonight, but he'll be back tomorrow, hopefully well rested after that trip.
And so, I don't know what color they wear on their ribbons.
Nor do I.
Maybe ribbons. They'll bring us some from the event.
Terrific. Well, tonight, I want to talk about marriage. You're a married guy, Bill.
I'm a married guy.
I'm not
almost
yet married.
Almost a quarter century, as a matter of fact.
I hope to be married someday. We'll talk about that. There are some pastors who were charged with a crime for not marrying people in Idaho, and I've got beef with that. I want to talk about it. Plus, we'll talk about what dreams are made of. And the joy of clothing.
And we'll just talk a little bit of treason about tyranny.
Yeah, that's right. While calming the hamster in your brain tonight. So that's the picture. That's what's going on. Yeah. And I want to start off just establishing your creds as the married guy that's talking on the subject of marriage tonight. How long have you been married?
Nearly a quarter century.
Wow.
I have 5 children and only one remaining in the home. And my beautiful bride of all those years, and that's how long we've been married. We've been together for a quarter century exactly, if not a little more. So
how do you feel about marriage?
I like marriage. It's a tempestuous relationship in the best of marriages, especially between my wife and I, because we happen to be both very bullheaded and stubborn. And I wouldn't say fixed in our ways, but we're comfortable in our ways. We're both rather bright and intuitive about the world. Sometimes we have slightly varying opinions. And she's something like a hurricane because she's a redhead.
So how does what's the secret to a happy marriage?
You know, I couldn't give you the answer to that. And the reason I can't is because there are so many different variables out there on how those marriages work out and how those relationships work out. To give you a tired old piece of advice, though, you have to be willing to bend and not be firm so that you can bend to what the differences are that both of you may have, no matter how many interests you may share.
I used to phone up old people who were lonely, who signed up for a hotline where they would get calls regularly. And it was one of the greatest times of volunteering that I got to do, because one of the old men who I spoke with gave me a similar piece of advice. And I wonder if you agree with it. He said, and he had been married, I think, for over 50 years. So he's got a real long one going. And he said, the secret is never fight. Just never fight. There's nothing to fight about. Like, just if it's something, you know, oh, hey, you put the Coke in the fridge. No, I didn't. You know, okay, All right. You know, it's not worth it. Most fights and petty disagreements that cause fractures in a relationship just aren't worth it. They're over small, petty things.
I think there's truth to that, because it, most of the time it tends to be something that if you looked at the long view of it, it would be absolutely inconsequential.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's one of the secrets of marriage. There. Yeah, I agree. So why am I asking about marriage? Because there are some Idaho pastors who are suing in a federal lawsuit against their city, because their city in Idaho made a law, Bill, that says you can't discriminate against anyone based on, you know, age, gender, and sexual orientation. Now, they perform marriages. They've performed, I think, over 35,000 marriages in their careers. And now they're threatened with jail time and thousands of dollars in fines for every day that they don't marry gay couples in Idaho. Just because that's against their conscience. That's against their religious convictions.
And as a matter of fact, they hail from Coeur d'Alene, which is approximately 20 miles south from where we used to live in North Idaho ourselves.
Oh, wow. You're familiar with that?
We are. We're very familiar with the area. Coeur d'Alene, as a matter of fact, North Idaho is probably, in the lower 48 states, one of the most geographically beautiful places in the lower 48, bar none.
So tell me more about the demographics there. Is it a college area? Is it a suburban area?
Coeur d'Alene has a community college, because one of the biggest colleges in Idaho is about 2 hours south of what's called Moscow, which is right on the Washington border, from which my oldest son graduated with a mechanical engineering MS.
Oh, wow.
He has BS there also.
So what's the politics around that area?
Beautiful. Because, it's very Republican.
Ah, well, that's interesting. Why would that be that they would make this law that would force a pastor to marry gay couples?
You know, if I may, number one, I'm opposed to gay marriage for the same reason I'm opposed to hetero marriage, which is that the state should have nothing whatsoever to do with this most sacred of contracts. If anything, it muddies and dirties the contract. But the reason why both heteros and gays pursue this contract is because of the benefits, both federal and lower, that accrue from the state recognizing this. And that's what drives a lot of this. Here's my first question with this whole thing. If I'm a pastor who doesn't want to marry gay folks, guess what? If you're gay, you don't have to force them to do that. You can find somebody else in that county who will do it for you.
Yeah, that's what I would think. And why would you want someone who doesn't want to marry you? Why would you want to force them to perform
a
ceremony?
Because they want to rub their noses in their refusal.
That is just too much for me. It's like, you know, hey, if someone tells you they're not interested, and then you use force to make them perform a service, I mean, that is really evil.
It is. And I think, you know what? You've dug to the root of this entire controversy, which is that, and you've heard me say this before, if you can't advance your refusal, if you can't withdraw your consent, if you cannot opt out, you are not free. And what they're basically saying to this pastor who doesn't want to marry gay couples is they're putting their finger in his chest and they're saying, you're not free to do as your conscience bears. You will do what the state tells you to do. So when you describe this as evil, I agree 100%.
What would your ideal form of marriage look like? You said, I'm against gay marriage and I'm against straight marriage. Well, what do you mean? What are you for?
Civil adjudication, where much like the independent laboratories, all the professional organizations that are out there, let's suppose the ABA was unharnessed from the American Bar Association, was unharnessed from the government. Any organization that's a professional organization, and I'm certain I'm not a pastor, nor am I a religionist, but I'm certain that there are private organizations out there that are evangelical, Roman Catholic, whatever the case may be, I'll bet they could set forth the standards that people could voluntarily comply with to conduct civil unions that are independent of the state. So that would be my ideal.
Yeah. And what did you call it? What was your term?
Civil unions.
Oh, okay. Civil unions. That's a good enough term, I think. Well,
yeah, I mean, if you want to call it marriage, but you know what? If you want to marry your chicken, you should be able to do that. And maybe you could even marry your chicken over the internet.
Oh, you know? Now you're talking crazy. Because isn't that what everyone was afraid of? Isn't that what they said? You can't have gay marriage.
Wait a minute. If your neighbor's married to his chicken, so what does it matter to you?
I don't know. I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
What if he's married to a 1956 frozen food dinner that he saved?
You know, that's all well and good. I won't interfere because I'm not involved in that relationship, and I don't want to have any part of it. And, you know, people can have whatever consensual relationships they want.
And I think that's where it all comes down to is consensual, because the point that's being made here is the mayor of the city is saying, I don't care about consent. You will do what I tell you, or I will fine you, kidnap you, cage you, maim you, or kill you, depending on your level of resistance when I send my enforcers your way.
Yeah, well, he's meeting some resistance. Fortunately, these
pastors...
I think
it's a she, is it not?
Oh, you know, I'm not sure. I'll have to discover that during the course of the article. But
and I may have this confused because I know that there is a gay mayor out there who's pushing this thing.
Uh-oh.
And I don't think that's Idaho. I think that's Texas.
Gay mayor. Yep. Pushing the agenda. Well,
exactly.
Allow me to read for a moment from Reuters article. Apparently, two pastors in Idaho who fear they could be penalized for refusing to perform newly legal gay marriages at their private wedding chapel have filed a lawsuit saying an Idaho anti-discrimination law violates their right to free speech and religious liberty. I agree with that.
I do, too. I agree 100% with it.
Donald and Evelyn Knapp, who run
Ask yourself here, too, who's the victim? Where is the victim? Have you seen that so many of these alleged crimes, the victim is the state?
That's right. Yeah, you disobeyed one of our laws.
Indeed.
Isn't that the ultimate crime?
It is. It is.
Yeah, sometimes people get more time for disobeying outright than they do for just concealing a crime. This is Freedom Fiends. We'll be back.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Doing a little meow therapy with the Freedom Fiends. Welcome back. This is Derek J. With me, Bill. Hey, Bill.
Bill Buepert, ZeroGov.com.
That's right. And we're talking about some pastors who were threatened with jail time after marrying 35,000 people. That wasn't good enough. The town in which they live says, go directly to jail. Do not pass go.
We'll see what happens. It's very interesting this happens in such a conservative state, because Idaho is known as one of the most conservative states in the union. But what's interesting about Idaho is that the whole Mayab thing, mind your own business.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge meme up there. There's a deep libertarian streak in Idaho, especially in the North Panhandle, of just wanting to be left alone. That's in constant combat with their basic conservative.
Well, apparently not, because now the law has stepped all over these people's right to free speech and religious liberty.
Well, I have to point something out here, though, and that's this. Remember that this is yet another case where a single individual empowered through the franchise can cause all kinds of havoc and mayhem that may have virtually no reflection whatsoever of what everybody feels in that community.
And so what do you mean by that? Like, one person could take the reins of power and write a law that says, like,
absolutely,
you can't discriminate against gays, got to protect them.
We have 535 know-nothings in the Congress who do that. We have Obama, and then you go to every state house, you go to every governor's mansion, you go to every mayoral office and you have that same kind of Hayekian fatal conceit where they know what's best for the rest of us. And if we don't like it, well, we'll just have to face their thin black and blue line of bullies.
Yeah. Well, I am just so frustrated by this story because I expected more moral outrage from the gay community. Like, I expected maybe some large gay groups to say, like, hey, this is wrong. You can't threaten pastors with jail just because they don't want to marry us. Leave them alone. You know, bullies, we understand bullying, and we recognize it when we see it. Stop bullying these pastors. That's not nice.
Now, they can't stop from bullying, though, because ask yourself this question, and this goes back to first principles. You hear the government talk about bullying in the schools, but if the government itself, from the state to the local level, couldn't bully, how could they accomplish anything?
If they couldn't bully. Yeah, they are a bunch of bullies.
No, well, that's exactly what they are.
I feel it when
terrorism is used as a primary means of doing what they do.
And I feel it when I see the blue lights behind me in a car, even if they're not pulling me over. You know, you see the blue lights. Uh-oh.
Absolutely, because you never know whether you're going to live the next 5 minutes.
Well,
with the cockroaches in America today.
Sometimes that is the case. That's not really one of my fears. I know that that might be a rational fear given what's in the news lately, but no, that's not something I'm terribly concerned about. Is it something you worry about?
Well, it always is. I mean, I've always had a high sense of security and awareness of my surroundings and what's going on. And I always prepare for the worst case scenario.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
and I always assume the worst behavior from those people who are not only elected officials, but the willing bully boys who work for the elected officials. Because, you know, the police state in America doesn't work for the people. They obey the rulers and do what the rulers tell them to do.
Would you like to hear more about Donald and Evelyn Knapp? The Peaceful Resistors?
I would.
Well, they run a place called the Hitching Post Wedding Chapel in Coeur d'Alene, and they're asking a federal judge to temporarily bar the city from enforcing the local ordinance that bans discrimination tied to sexual orientation in businesses that are used by the public. And the couple are both Christian ministers, ordained, and they say that they could face up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine for each time they decline to wed same-sex couples, even though that's part of their religious beliefs. I mean, I can't imagine being told, I mean, this is not my belief. I believe differently from them, but I can't imagine being told that I have to go against my convictions. It's so offensive to the root. I don't know if it strikes you
and I wouldn't recommend anybody purchase a gun from a gun shop, but you own a gun shop and the government says you must sell to criminals.
Yeah, wouldn't that be something you
wouldn't
just say,
silly?
No,
couldn't
do that.
Right.
It's against their convictions.
Yeah.
So,
and by the way, you know, if you own a restaurant and you don't want to serve certain ethnicities or anybody else, that's your fundamental right of association.
Well, the government's going to escalate the jail time and fines. We'll find out what happens after they file a federal lawsuit and we hear from the other authorities.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Meow, 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 meow. Worms.
Analytes.
Worms. This is the Freedom Fiends. And yes, we're beaming this into space. We're talking about freedom, as always, focused on freedom. Here, Bill Bupert of ZeroGov.com. And I am Derek J. of DerekJ.me. You can learn about me over there.
I joined Liberty.me, by the way.
Oh, you did?
I did.
How do you like it?
Make sure you send a friend request to me. I just started today.
So Liberty.me is a... What is it?
Well, it apparently is Jeff Tucker's latest enterprise, who is one of the luminaries in the Liberty movement as we speak.
And it's a social media network.
It is. It also has discussion forums, and I guess you could call it a big, nice, warm meeting place for libertarians, both minarchists and abolitionists.
Cool. Well, I'm not yet a part of it. My website is not associated with liberty.me. It is just a .me address. So it's just DerekJ.me. But tell me more about this social network that you're a part of, because I always wanted another option besides Facebook. We can get back to the marriage thing. We'll get back to that, because this isn't going away.
I am not a Facebook person. I've never had an account. Never have an account. And I don't use Google, for instance. I use Startpage.
Any social networking?
Social media is not attractive to me.
No? No Twitter?
I do have Twitter.
Okay, and there you go.
Here's the reason why I have Twitter, though. I was told by my editor, she said, the quickest and best way, if you were a budding or established author, to get book sales really pumped for both the time that your book originally comes out and while it's out and been published and on the shelves for a few weeks or a few months, is Twitter. She said that Twitter is almost a silver bullet.
Makes sense.
So that's my original reason for doing Twitter. But in the Twitter community, there's a large number of anarchists and abolitionists and libertarians out there.
Abolitionists. I love using that term. You've introduced me to that term. Well, what do you mean when you say abolitionist? I know I've asked you this before, but you've got such a perfect, like, rehearsed definition. I want to learn it.
That's so kind of you. Anarchy has a lot of political baggage that makes the Buboisi in America fill their pants. So I employ the term abolitionist, which means that I am opposed to all forms of human slavery. And it's great for conversational tropes where gentlemen like you and I and Michael and the rest of us in the abolitionist and libertarian community are encountering people who happen to be collectivist or state or government supremacist or neoconservatives or whatever ilk it is where they have a childlike reverence for the power of the state to do good things. And the question you and I can ask when they say, well, what's an abolitionist? We say, I'm an abolitionist because I'm opposed to all forms of human slavery and ownership. What forms of human slavery do you support?
I support pastors having to marry gay couples.
And that's what they would say. By the way, there just so happens to be in Rome, of all places, the mayor, Ignacio Marino. He joined a budding political rebellion by a growing number of mayors around Italy who will not conduct gay marriages.
All right. And is that just that's a voluntary association? That's just a thing they're saying, hey, we're not going to do it.
Indeed. You know, you and I were talking during the break about this whole gay marriage tempest and teapot, because I think that's what this is. But in the end, why would you want to compel somebody to make this most sacred contract, this contract that takes a lot of investment, not only to get there at the altar, but everything involved after the altar, hopefully until your deathbed, if you remain a couple? Why would you want to force people to conduct such a beautiful thing when you can find other people who will, just to put your finger in their chest and say, I'm going to make you do it, even if it goes against your beliefs? Imagine I'm a Protestant pastor or Catholic, or I'm a Jewish rabbi, and a couple Satanists come and they say, we'd like you to wed us. And I say, you know, I can't subscribe to that. And I can't do that within my present offices. Well, they go to the government and the government makes you do it. That's wrong.
Could you imagine if dating or marriage worked that way? Well, sorry, well, you don't want to marry me. What's that? Yeah, you have to get a dating license. Yeah, sorry you don't want to marry me, but it says here on your license that you have to. So, sorry. Yeah. It's the law. Or go to jail.
Crazy.
Those are your choices. So I'm glad these pastors are standing up and saying no. And I want to be clear that just because, like, being against these pastors getting punishment doesn't mean against gay marriage. Because I am for people contracting however they want. Whatever,
I am,
you know,
too, as long as they don't use the state to do so.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I think that just opens up a whole can of worms. That impoverishes everybody.
Can of annelids.
A can of annelids, indeed.
So the Knapps claim that they respectfully declined the ceremony. I believe them. They say they've hosted roughly 35,000 weddings since opening in 1989. the year that's the year I was born. So during my entire lifetime, they've been marrying people, and now at the time they should be retiring in their golden years together, they are threatened with jail time. It's just unreal to me. You know, I did that movie bill, Victimless Crime Spree.
Yeah.
To focus on how many victimless crimes there are out there. Of course, this is another one that involves no victims. No one's getting hurt except the state. And, you know, but it still surprises me when stuff like this comes down, because they're just, look at who the targets are. I mean, they're not tattooed, angry face, leather jacket wearing criminals. They're pastors who want to marry people, you know, just not everybody. And like you said, it would be really weird if they were like, well, you have to marry Satanists. But who knows? That might be next. Or,
you know, maybe whatever the peccadillo is that they happen to have, that they're morally affronted by, whether it be BDSM, which between consenting adults is perfectly fine, it appears to me, or people practicing other things, if you can't morally support it, why should you be compelled to go against your own conscience?
Yeah, I think that's what it's really about, is the conscience. Hey, there's something similar happening in Houston with the mayor there. Can you tell me something about that?
Isn't that interesting? Is that the one about the driver's license?
Yes.
Yeah, well, it appears that the mayor had a child with her wife, and the child went to get a driver's license and was denied by the Texas DMV to get the driver's license because she could not establish that her parents were hetero, because she had two women as parents, and that confused the dimwits at the DMV.
So is that not allowed? I want to be clear. Is she not allowed to get a driver's license if she has gay parents?
Isn't that interesting? Imagine the can of worms that opens up, because not only would it be an affront to homosexuals adopting children or having children, however they come about doing that. But it would also say, because your parents did the following thing, we're going to reinstitute the kind of debtor's prison that existed in Great Britain and Europe in the 18th and 19th century, where if your father was in debt and he passes on, you're going to inherit that debt, and
we're going to
put the mark of the devil on you.
Yeah, the stigma just follows.
the stigmata.
Yeah. Well, why don't we just move over to a caste system and have everyone wear armbands? Wouldn't that be easier? You know, right?
Oh, well, speaking of armbands, it's interesting, in Israel, I just read this today, they're making certain Palestinians wear yellow insignia.
What?
On their clothing, yes.
Well, get out of here.
I am serious.
You saw this?
I did. I'll send it to you.
Wow, that is remarkable.
Now, for those in the audience who are historically short-term, the yellow insignia that was worn by Jews during World War II in Germany marked them for certain very unpleasant demises, or being imprisoned, or just being treated as second, third, and fourth class citizens as a result of who they were as Jews.
You know, why do you think that is? Why does that seem to happen throughout history, these separations into different groups like this? I guess it's a control or a separate, and what's it called? Divide and conquer.
I think it all comes down to state supremacism.
Yeah.
State supremacists, they love war, for instance, but they've also discovered that if they do divide and conquer, as you just say, where they say, you know what, the Japanese in World War II, those guys are subhuman. They squint, they wear thick lenses, they've got buck teeth, they're little fellas, and they make funny noises. So they're not like us. And because of that, it's going to be easier to kill them.
Yeah, I think that's the problem. I think that's what it is. It's the state butting in where it doesn't belong and making problems where they otherwise wouldn't exist. Like, oh, hey, I want to get married at your chapel. Oh, that's, sorry, we can't do that. I'm not interested.
That's right.
And it's like, okay, I'll move along to the next person in the phone book. You know, big deal.
It's crazy.
You know, it would be the same situation if there was like, oh, it has to be July 4th. Oh, sorry, we're booked for July 4th. Well, okay, move along to the next person. It's like, well, you know, do you have to serve someone? What are the conditions of serving another person?
Well, the conditions here, of course, are that you will do so, or your peril will be the same I described earlier, which is that you will be fined, kidnapped, caged, maimed, or killed, depending on your level of resistance.
I think this is going to be a turnaround moment, though. There's no way they can invoke a sentence like this. They're going to realize that we've gone too far with legislating morality.
I think so. By the way, you were asking me about that, and I'm going to send you the documentation that we can put in the show notes concerning the orange and yellow ID cards and passports issued to Palestinians.
Yes. Got to know about them. So what's the solution for this gay marriage or mayor in Houston? What's the solution for her poor daughter? Was she able to get a license?
I think she did.
Okay, terrific.
I think it was embarrassment on the part of the Texas DMV at the time, because they were sort of caught by their own regulatory idiocy.
Well, I put the onus on, you know, the gay groups who do outreach and campaign for political issues to say, hey, we need to be vocally against prosecuting innocent, victimless criminals like the Knapps and pastors like them who politely decline to marry our ilk. You know, they should have the freedom to. And we wouldn't want to serve them if they came into our places of business and started calling us nasty names. We all want the freedom.
I've seen some of the nasty bromides that the left gay movement issues against conservatives and Christians and evangelicals and the rest of them, and some of their descriptions of them, and they're just as evil and banal as what conservatives cast at gays, those who choose to do so.
Worms.
Annelids.
Hey, we've talked a lot about marriage. When we come back, I want to talk about dreams. What are your dreams made of?
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Meow. Meow.
Meow.
Meow, meow, worms.
Annelids.
Annelids. This is the Freedom Fiends. And we're talking about the importance of marriage and consent.
Consent. I need to make one minor correction, if I may.
What?
I said yellow ID cards. I want to say orange ID cards.
Oh.
They are orange, green, and blue that are issued to Palestinians. But the orange ones are for those Palestinians who hail from the Gaza Strip and parts of Israel and East Jerusalem.
Okay. There's our correction. It's orange, not yellow.
Well, that's right, because we pride ourselves on the fiends with our linguistic specificity.
And accuracy.
Indeed.
So tell me more about what the value of marriage here, because I would like to be married, but not... what was the term you used? Civil union? I don't like that term, though. It doesn't seem as lovey. You know, it just seems cold.
Here's the joy of it, though. Again, to language. You can get a civil union, and you can look into the eyes of your partner, and you could say, you know what? We have a marriage here. We have a union between our hearts that will last as long as we wish to remain with each other, regardless of what the government tells us, because this contract is between you and I, and not between you and I and a pastor, and not between you and I and a justice of the peace.
I do.
You're such a romantic.
You are such a romantic. You are. I mean, wow. So, yeah, you don't need the state to have a happy marriage or a real bond or a partnership. I don't even think you need a contract on paper. Would you go that far? Would you contract on paper? Is that what you did?
Well, you know what? Remember, we're in a Milgram Stanford experiment here where most people suffer from the Stockholm syndrome. And because of that, we have money forcefully taken from us, both now and in the future, and from our unborn progeny, for things that you and I don't approve of. But if we don't have these instruments, these legal instruments that the state has forced our hand and bent our arms backwards around our backs to get, we're not going to fare as well as our neighbors. We will not prosper as much. Unfortunately, we have to compromise because of how the state has bent and twisted marriage into a thing it shouldn't be.
Well, I want to call it something new. We'll think of something good, something that sounds lovey. Because that's not.
Don't let the state take the word marriage.
No.
If you like the word marriage, take it.
Okay, you're right. Yeah, I don't want to let them poison such a good word. And, you know, they never belonged, in my opinion, intruding. I guess the original intent in involving the state, to be fair, was to add your name to a registry, right? You wanted to keep everyone in town. You wanted to keep all the family trees in order. You wanted to know the history of your town and your area. Isn't that the original intent of having the state involved?
You could have a family historian, but we all know that when you look back in human history, you find that some of the first written records found that were still legible were simply tax records. I mean, you know,
well, that's what's more important, right?
We all know that being tax cattle is very important to the government.
Yeah, way more important than keeping a registry of names. Yeah, I guess you could always have that contracted out privately, a family historian.
You
makes a lot of sense.
Could. I mean, it's like estates and wills and things like that. They're affected by the state, but you can manipulate them and you can craft them and you can write them in a way that benefits your family. And you are the self-interested party that would do that. And the government isn't interested in any of that. They're only interested in the amount of power they can maintain or expand at your expense and how much money they can drain out of you and your unborn progeny.
Do you think marriage has lost its relevance, Bill?
No, I don't. I think marriage is a soulful universal that will never go away, even if you have to hide it from the state like they did in the USSR, when you had actual religious marriages taking place in the underground Orthodox Christian church in the Soviet Union, where it was valuable for couples to have that marriage certification from an underground priest.
Wow, that's so brave. Crazy, but brave.
It is. It is.
Oh, no. We didn't even get to talk about dreams yet. Well, hey, don't start dreaming yet. We've got more Freedom Fiends when we come back. And I want to talk about how we can control our dreams and start to merge dream world with reality. But not daydreaming. Bill, what's the quote about that?
I'm going to save that for the next segment.
Oh! All right, when we come back, lucid dreaming, control your dreams, and make a better reality for you and the world. Worms. Shire. And across the inner tubes, it's Bill Buppert.
ZeroGov.com.
That's
Derek,
right.
How are you?
I am just spectacular. I am feeling on top of the world. You know, this weather is just really getting me excited for going outside and stomping on leaves and seeing all the pretty colors. I'm changing clothes. I'm wearing thermals now and scarves and jackets. It's fun. Don't you love this time of year?
Well, I do. And of course, our weather here in southern Arizona is quite a bit different from yours. And we live at 5,000 feet. So we're in the high desert southwest. And this is where our evenings start getting really nice and cool, 40s, 50s on occasion. And it's wonderful. I like it.
That's about what it is here tonight. It's lovely.
But we don't have snow, which makes me delighted.
Yeah, that would be one nice thing. It looks very pretty in the wintertime.
Inside.
Well, yes, right. So, you know, I want to talk about dreaming a little bit, Bill, because I have been fascinated with the idea of lucid dreaming since I was a little kid. I studied it in school during an independent study. And the idea is you can control your dreams if you think about it and if you train yourself. You can spend that time that you would normally be spending, you know, off in space fighting aliens or whatever. You can spend that time productively practicing whatever skills you might use in the real world. Pretty cool, right?
I'm a skeptic.
Really?
Oh, indeed.
Do you dream?
I'm all about daytime dreaming.
Tell me more.
Well, one of my influences is T.E. Lawrence, better known as Lawrence of Arabia, both his writing and his action. And one of the things that Lawrence said that's really intriguing to me is he said, "All men dream, but not equally. Those who dream by night in the dusty recesses of their minds wake up in the day to find that it was vanity. But the dreamers of the day are dangerous men, for they may act on their dreams with open eyes to make them possible." Now, I think that's a great quote, and of course you can see the literary tilt and lilt to that. That's just gorgeous to either read or hear in the ear. But again, there is Michael Collins from the Irish Revolution at the turn of the 20th century, who was deemed a practical visionary, a dreamer during the day at the time, and that scared the starch out of Winston Churchill.
Well, what
it
this
scares totalitarians.
It does.
Was the same way.
That's what, yeah, absolutely. They're afraid of dreamers, people who might behave on their dreams, act on their principles in real life, not just in the dream world. But what this
because
story
as abolitionists, we're dreamers because we dream of a society that is built not on violence, not on threats, not on ugly evil, but that's built on peaceful cooperation, persuasion, gentle argumentation, gentlemanly ways, exquisite etiquette, and just almost a rock solid commitment to not going to blows over anything unless it's completely necessary.
Now, I absolutely agree with you, but you say you're a skeptic to this idea of lucid dreaming. Well, turns out
I am indeed.
The Wall Street Journal has an article from just this August, just a little about 2 months ago, published about the benefits of lucid dreaming. Researchers decipher clues from those with greater awareness and control of behavior in dreams. And it seems like they did a study, and I'll just paraphrase a bit here, that they had some of their test subjects who were especially good at lucid dreaming, controlling their dreams, practice certain tasks like throwing darts and throwing pennies into cups, and they tested their performance on day one, had them dream the practice of throwing pennies into cups or throwing darts, and then the next day tested them again. Their scores dramatically improved, as if they had been practicing.
How do you make somebody dream? How do you do that?
Well,
and how do you know they dreamed about the things you told them to dream about before they go to sleep?
Maybe they tell you. They tell you if they and lucid dreaming means they can control their dreams. So, you know, the idea is, have you ever been awake in a dream? Have you ever realized that you're dreaming?
You know, I have to say I'm probably the exception to the rule in humanity here, where I don't do a lot of dreaming at all.
Wow. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's the case for me as well. And I'm such a big fan of dreams and dreaming. I'm fascinated by this
subject. But that's because you dream during the day.
Well, yes, it is true. But I try and merge the two because, you know, why waste the time that I'm laying in a bed, you know, recharging my batteries when I could be spending that time contributing to, you know, the Freedom Project that I care so much about?
Yeah, I think so, too. But I just don't have enough information about it.
Okay,
so I'll let you carry on about it.
Well, let me break it down. I've got this article from the Wall Street Journal. They write, Anthony Bloxham was standing in the garden of his house when he wondered if he was dreaming. To figure it out, he looked at his hands. Experts in a phenomenon known as lucid dreaming, where sleeping people are aware they're in a dream, say dreamers should look for reality checks or details that look different in dreams than in real life. Indeed, Mr. Bloxham's hand was glowing yellow, so he realized he was asleep. So that's how you're able to do it. I've had this happen personally, Bill, where I've been testing to see, hey, this seems funny. I don't think this is reality. Is this real life? And you look and you see, you know, either a light switch is broken and won't turn off and on, or your watch is changing all sorts of bizarre and different characters that make no sense. You know, something can tip you off that this is a dream world. This isn't reality. And I think
I'm
gonna
take your word for it.
Well, yeah, I guess you'll have to. You know, some lucid dreamers are able to control elements of their dream once they realize they're dreaming. And, you know, that means they end up flying or meeting famous people. And yeah, I think that you could take someone's word for it and just say, okay, did you dream about this? Most people can recall their dreams if they practice it or write it down in a journal. That's one way that they suggest people develop this skill of lucid dreaming, is to keep a journal next to your bed and write about what you dream about. After a while, you'll start to perhaps recognize patterns, and you can recognize when you're dreaming, and then start to use that time for whatever valuable purpose you want to put it towards. What would you put the extra 8 hours or whatever you use sleeping? What would you put that towards, Bill, if you had an extra 8 hours in the day?
Gosh, it'd be astonishing. I wish I could get it back. But the thing that I do is I'd probably, you know, the trope is spend more time with your family. I try to do that. And I would read and I would write and I would spend more time at the range in preparation for the coming endarkenment.
Whoa, wouldn't that be cool if you could practice firing, if your target practice in your sleep?
Now, as a matter of fact, we have employed visualization skills to improve that, but it isn't while I'm sleeping.
What do you mean? While you're awake, you practice
exactly,
visualization
practice.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, researchers are studying people like Mr. Bloxam to understand if lucid dreaming can improve dreamers' abilities when they're awake. Psychologists at the University of London in England found in June a study that people with frequent lucid dreams are better at cognitive tasks that involve insight, like problem solving. So this could be very helpful to you, Bill. You might want to develop this skill. You know, why not? What have we got to lose?
I will take that under advisement and give it a try.
You know, other researchers have shown that people who dream of practicing a routine can improve their abilities in that activity in real life. And that would be awesome for going target shooting. You know, I often want to go down to the range, but I don't have the time, or I don't want to spend the money on ammo. Think about it. Endless ammo, any gun you would want to try, you could try them all, because, you know, it's a dream. So you could have whatever kind of one you want.
It sort of reminds me of Total Recall.
It's the whole premise
where Total Recall is where you buy memories that are implanted in you.
Oh, cool.
Like, I want to be a secret agent. I want to be a soldier. I want to be a stockbroker. Yeah. I want to be, you know, something like that.
Yeah, well, I guess the whole thing about lucid dreaming or dreaming in general, aren't thoughts shapes? Don't they have a shape in your brain? The electrical signal follows some sort of pattern to signify
I would think that they do, but I would also assume that this is a chicken and the egg concept, but does language form thoughts or do thoughts form language? Mm. Most people are of the opinion who study that kind of thing say that language dictates your world perspective and how you think, and I think there's a lot of merit to that. For instance, why do Asians think differently in certain respects than non-Asians do? And some people speculate, such as Malcolm Gladwell, he talks about the rice paddy complex. He says that one reason why Asians may be, and this is all sheerly speculative, one reason Asians may so excel at mathematics and science and engineering at a gradient that's a little more than the West, as it were, in the European West, is because of the problem set of maintaining a rice paddy over years and how complex that is to do.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if that is the answer.
Maybe they do some lucid dreaming for rice planting. I don't know.
Like, you know, it doesn't have to just be lucid dreaming. As you mentioned, practicing visualization while you're awake is even valuable. I mean, what sort of tasks do you practice there at the range?
Certainly. Yeah, where what you'll do, for instance, is dry fire practice is a form of visualization where you have no ammunition whatsoever, but you're simulating the manipulation of the handgun or the rifle in a situation that is as close to reality as you can make it.
Yeah. You know, it seems like if I could, and I hate to invoke authority figures and authorities in air quotes, but if I could lucid dream anything, I might talk to the president, just have a sit down chat and see where we could find some common ground. See if I could, you know, there's this, this is a real pipe dream, but imagining being able to say the magic words that get him to understand where I'm coming from, you know, and we really understand each other. That would be really cool.
I actually think that's truly a pipe dream.
Oh, I hope not. Because
absent teleprompters, I don't think anything goes on in his cognition.
Oh, cyborg president, huh?
Collectivist.
Could be. Who knows? What's going on in your dreams? And if you could get an extra 8 hours to do whatever you wanted, what would you do with it? Is this real life?
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Worms. Welcome back. This is the Freedom Fiends. Hazing you with liberty. And talking about dreams, wake dreams, sleep time dreams, is this a dream? Hopefully, you can control your dreams and make use of that 8 hours of time or however long it is you go to sleep. Put it to good use. What would you do with that time? I've been thinking about it, Bill. Not only would I sit down with the president, I would fly. I think that's probably the number one answer of what people would do if they could control their dreams. What about you? You said you weren't sure. Have you had more time to think about it?
Not sufficient. I'm a rather slow person when it comes to coming to those kind of conclusions. But I think, you know what, I'd love... I have to sleep 8 to 9 hours a night. That's just the way I'm genetically gifted. But I wish I could live on 2 to 3 hours because you do the multiplication and look at all the time you could spend getting better at whatever it is you want to achieve or, you know, whatever your goal is, you could be that much closer. So, you know, if lucid dreaming works and there's members of the audience who can do that, then bully for them.
I think that would be, you know, if lucid dreaming is a real thing, and I think it is. I would consider myself to have done it a few times throughout my life and without, you know, I'm 25, so I've been studying this maybe a little more than 10 years, so that's not a good record, I would say. I've had a lot of dreams, not been able to control very many of them. But, you know, what's cool about this is if it is a real skill, this is something that anyone could develop to give themselves total freedom in their heads. Like, you know, I say freedom's in your head a lot, but this would be like the ultimate for real. If people are, you know, if they're stuck indoors, maybe they have a
debilitating disease. It all comes down to taking your right index finger and putting it on your temple and saying, the revolution begins here, and clicking your heels and moving forward.
Yeah, that's important because, like, you know, we can't have the future of peace and freedom that we want without imagining it first. It definitely
because imagination is probably the most powerful engine for bringing about the changes that we seek.
Yeah, and what kind of changes, you know, what would that look like to you?
Well, for me, it's so simple. It's almost sublime in that, and it's twofold. Number one, the ZNAP, the zero non-aggression principle, where no aggression takes place unless you're responding to aggression against you, and forming society on nonviolence. And it all seems so simple to us, yet we are surrounded by a world, a planet, a nation, and our neighbors and our friends and even members of our family who have so grown used to using violence to form society, they cannot imagine another way to do it.
You know, I don't think it would have to look terribly different from the world we inhabit today. hear a lot of people talk about an anarchist society as something it's a utopic idea. It will never happen. But I think we have, first of all, we have a lot of anarchy around us every day. The spaces.
Every day, everybody practices anarchy. Even the POTUS practices it.
Yeah. Well, we're just walking around in a public space. We experience anarchy. No one tells you which way to walk. And you don't, you know, of course, some people bump into each other, but it's a pretty rare occurrence. And we're able to sort these things out without a leader telling us which way to walk and, you know, how fast and that stuff.
But Edward Abbey would tell us that grown men don't need leaders.
Yeah, and I feel that way. I don't know if I shared this with you before, but I feel like one of the ways that I've dreamed more freedom into my life is by imagining and seeing others do things like run a stop sign. And I don't mean run a stop sign, like plowing through it without any regard for what's around, but, you know, using your head, looking around, using your eyes, assessing the situation and determining the safety for yourself. And choosing whether or not to go or stop, not based on what the state sign tells you to do, but based on what your head and your senses tell you what to do.
It's what former Governor Gary Johnson would say. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. You're at a four-way stop. It's a rural stop. You're in the middle of nowhere. There's no one to be seen for miles, and you can see for miles. And you know you're a libertarian because you run that stop sign.
That's right. I do. I do things like that. And it feels good to know that the state isn't sucking away my valuable time, which is the only commodity I've really got in this world. It's the only one that the sand in the hourglass just drains away. And I'm not going to let the state take it just because they have a red light.
And if you don't make the most of every moment, you're robbing yourself.
That's right. So live free, and it starts in your head, and then it works its way down to your feet. This is the Freedom Fiends. We'll be back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
Doing some meow therapy. It makes me feel good, but Bill says, he's got too much dignity for meowing. What about that, Bill?
I love cats. As a matter of fact, I have 3 cats. We've had as many as 7. And one thing that I love about cats is that they are nature's natural-born anarchists.
Are they?
I saw this great meme where it had a picture of a dog at the top and a cat at the bottom. A dog at the top says, look, they're home. They must be gods because they take care of him. The bottom picture with the cat says, oh, they're home. They take care of me. They feed me. They groom me. Everything else. I must be a god.
That is such the attitude, isn't it? Garfield was one of my favorite comic strips as a kid. He never appreciated what John, his owner, did for him or anything like that. I always had a cat. I think a lot of the Freedom Fiends hosts have cats. It seems to be an anarchist type personality. Yeah, dogs are real obedient and subservient. They love their masters, but cats, they're like, hey, I'm on my own. I do my own thing.
Exactly.
I don't worship
anyone. And I recommend anybody who gets a chance to watch the video, Dear Kitten. And some of its successors should do so in the audience.
Really? Now, we've been talking a lot about light stuff, dreams, and marriage, but I want to talk about something a little bit serious that's happening because it involves lives.
Why so serious?
Well, we don't have to be terribly serious about it, but okay. This is there's some real stuff going on here in Pennsylvania. Will you fill us in on what's going on there, Bill?
I just penned a blog posting called American Policing in the Coming Civil War, in which I talked about the Frine incident in Pennsylvania. two Pennsylvania troopers. One was wounded, one was killed. I think one is still in critical condition. The PSP, the Pennsylvania State Police, blame Frine and say that due to evidence that they found, they're pinning him as not only the suspect, but being judge, jury, and executioner. They're saying that Frine did it. And they've also put out what I consider to be an outrageous shoot to kill on sight order on Frine. They've spent thousands of manpower and man days and such trying to find this guy now for weeks in the forest of Pennsylvania. They have yet to do it. And what I'm trying to do is give people a framework to think this thing through, because Eric Rudolph, Troy James Knapp, Jason McVane, and Robert William Fisher have been several in the past who have escaped the cops, mainly through mountainous or rural areas, when they've been wanted and hunted men. Now, in the Appalachians, during the height of the bootlegging and the moonshining days, it was said that revenues could go into the hills in the Appalachians, and a lot of them would never return. There's several layers that we have to peel from this whole thing. First of all, the whole Frine thing of where they're saying, we're going to issue a shoot-to-kill order on this guy because he killed cops. Again, this speaks to thing. Anybody who has read my stuff or listened to me in podcasts before, I think that police forces and cops in America are the existential threat to human liberty, because quite simply, no political bad actor, you fill in the blank of who that may be, can do a thing to deprive a single individual of their liberty absent an enforcement mechanism or arm to do so, along with the Praetorians who would fill the ranks to do that very thing.
You know, that's a great point, Bill. Otherwise, all they would be is suggestions on paper.
Exactly. Because, and of course, this speaks to voting, and I've spoken to voting in the past month since we're running up on that, because voting is nothing more than you putting a piece of paper in the slave suggestion box on who the plantation owner is going to be for the next period of time that that office reigns.
So you said something interesting about how they're judge, jury, and executioner. They've decided that this guy did it, we know it, and we're going to kill him.
And I just think it's outrageous. But you find this happening consistently. These crimes are always solved, usually, it appears, when cops are the victim.
Now, people respond to incentives. And I want to know, when we come back. I want to know, people respond to incentives. So what incentive does it give the cop killer if he knows that there's an army of police after him?
Here's the incentive it gives him. He's killed a cop. They put a death penalty on him. So the first cop is going to be charged against him, but the rest are free. The incentive it gives him is that if you're not going to take me alive, as Solzhenitsyn would tell him, and I'm paraphrasing this, once you take everything out from a man, once you've stripped him of everything, you've made him a very dangerous individual. And that's what they've done with Frine. But another reason they do this is because they have to maintain this constant facade of invulnerability to cops. What I was saying is that we see this noise out there that says 400 people are murdered by cops every year. I'm here to tell you that number is 4 to 5 times that per annum. It's not what they're reporting. It's far more. Brian Burghardt of Fatal Encounters, and I urge your audience to go check that out. He's trying to find out exactly what that collated database looks like, because the feds, surprisingly enough, do not maintain a database on when rounds or vehicles are used by the cops to kill people. Well, they don't keep track of that on an annual basis.
What incentive would they have to do that?
Exactly. And my suspicion is, too, that people would be so outraged at the corpse pile on an annual basis that is left by American policing, that a lot of huge changes may take place. And much of those would probably be extra legal changes that the cops wouldn't like. We have to go back to the Dorner incident in California to really put this in the proper framework and vision, because what this is about is that Dorner took the state of California, and he made their law enforcement fill their pants and freeze.
Now, he was a former California patrol officer.
He was indeed. He was indeed in the LAPD.
And he went rogue and decided he was going to kill some of the other officers. Is that right?
He did. He did. Okay. And as a matter of fact, there was one surfer, a white surfer, who was not a black man. Dorner was a black man, whose Honda Ridgeline was perforated and ventilated by frightened and probably overfed cops who assaulted him, thinking he was Dorner. Older Hispanic women in a blue pickup, not matching the specifications by make, model, or color of what Dorner was allegedly driving, had 110 rounds pumped into their vehicle. Fortunately, they weren't hurt because cops are notoriously bad marksmen.
But you know, what cops a nightmare. Have to do the
thug scrum thing. It's a nightmare. And Frine, to me, the whole thing that I'm trying to put together here in this essay and my speculation is that Frine is an indicator of things to come. Imagine if there were a dozen or 100 Frines or Dorners in the same state.
Whoa.
Imagine
respond to that?
I don't think they'd respond very well. And with the number of combat veterans returning, and of course, all of us who are veterans who have served overseas, we're in the headlights of the DHS right now because they consider us potentially dangerous individuals. Anybody who has served in the military, and especially those who have served in combat operations overseas. But imagine combat vets come back, and not only would they be lone wolves, but maybe they would team together, band together, and for whatever reason, they take on the cops. The cops, by and large, when you look at story after anecdotal story on the net, they take down people who were usually unarmed, overmatched, and not ready to respond in any way except to lay down and take whatever abuse is heaped upon them, which in certain cases leads to maiming and death.
What motivates people like Frine and Dorner? Do you think they have a philosophical grounding?
No, I don't. No, I, you know what? And all I'm going to assume is thuggery on their part, because then if I'm mistaken and it turns out that they're enormously enlightened individuals like George Washington or others who are trying to free the country, then I'll be pleasantly surprised. I'm going to assume that they're thugs, but I'm never going to assume that the police have the right outside of a courtroom to decide the fate of this alleged thug by putting a kill order out on him. I mean, these kill orders aren't uncommon. We see Obama doing it in the Oval Office, and now we have cops emulating what's happening in the White House with drone strikes and such, and saying, well, you know what? Maybe we'll put out our own kill orders. It's so extra legal, extraordinarily immoral, and just unjust at the basis level. To me, it should be an affront to every free-thinking American.
It does make me think of the Terminator and those movies where there are cyborg police goons who just go around.
RoboCop.
And they have the authority, the legal authority, to decide whether or not someone has committed a crime, if they're guilty, and what the punishment will be. And then they get to dole out that punishment. Like our drones right around the corner. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I wonder that about drones, because we know that the fiends joke a lot about being drone proof and putting our episodes out on torrent, but you know, are drones the next tool of the authorities to punish so-called criminals?
I agree. You know, Alexander Solzhenitsyn has been a huge influence on me, as have a lot of writers, to include Rothbard and Abbey and others that I've suggested either on the show or shows in the past. I've got to read this quote, and I love reading quotes because it makes me appear smarter than I am. I don't do much work, and I'm reading this lovely stuff that may impel people to read it. This is from the Gulag Archipelago, and it says, "In keeping silent about evil and burying it so deep within us that no sign of it appears on the surface, we are implanting it, and it will rise up a thousandfold in the future. When we neither punish nor reproach evildoers, we are not simply protecting their trivial old age. We are thereby ripping the foundations of justice from beneath new generations." I mean, that's incredibly profound when you grok what he's saying. Because what he's saying is that if we don't stand up for what's right now, it's going to be far worse for anybody who succeeds us.
That's right. It's an important lesson, and it's one that's echoed so many times throughout history. I think it's time to heed that lesson.
It is. You know, look what happened at the Canadian War Memorial in the Parliament this past week, where you had the gunmen there. Okay, maybe they're Muslim extremists. I'll suspend my disbelief and suppose that they were. And I do think that when that sergeant at arms at the Parliament plink that guy and stop that gunman from continuing on his rampage, he was right. But what is the response by Harper and the Parliament? To say, we're going to use our CSIS, which is their equivalent of the United States CIA and NSA, and we're going to open up the privacy blinders, and we're going to examine everything every Canadian does. Wrong, wrong, wrong.
Wrong. We'll throw more moral outrage when the fiends return. Plus, we'll calm the hamster in your brain.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Worms, this is a Freedom Fiends, and that was the Warrant Canary. Warrant Canary. That's me,
and
Derek J.
This is the silver-haired snow leopard.
What sound do they make?
I think they growl.
Something like that.
You do it far better than I do, so I'm going to defer to your growling.
Okay, that's what sound they make, I think, and that's when they're happy. So you can.
So
imagine.
This is redemption in the third act. This is where, yep. Despite any impressions people had of, oy, the world is just crushing and I don't want to live any longer because it's just so awful. But it's not awful. And the point that I want to make about cops is this. Yes, they are an existential threat to human liberty. There's no doubt about it. But picture a world where every time a squad car stops a car on the side of the road, five cars stop behind it, and everybody gets out with their smartphones or their cameras, and they record the entire event at a safe distance from said cop and simply record to sort of let them know that we're watching you and we're keeping an eye on your behavior and your activities.
Man, that would be cool.
And the other thing we have to remember, too, is that cops aren't the only threat. The government is a threat. But what we know is this, is that whether it's the Mac, I'm a Mac guy, an Apple guy, whether it's SpaceX and commercial space travel, whether it's what Elon Musk is doing or Tesla is doing, the new cars that we see, whatever the case may be, every time you see a new invention or a new innovation or something where you say, wow, what a cool app, or I wish I could go that fast, or I love the clothes you're wearing. None of that came from a government entity. All of that came from a single brilliant mind that said, you know what? I have an idea, and I'm going to weaponize that idea in a peaceful fashion, and I'm going to sell it to people, and if they buy it, I'll make money. And if they don't like it, I'm going to move on to something more productive.
Wow, you do have a way of making me feel a lot more hopeful about the future. This is great. You know, the market really does provide, and I know that some libertarians get pigeonholed as some sort of like mantra believing cult, but you know, the market provides, it's the answer to everything, but it's really true. And the market is just, you know, you and me having ideas, putting stuff out, making offers to our friends and neighbors. And there's always some way to progress humanity, to get what we want, to meet
That's
each
it.
Other's needs.
I just read two brilliant books. One's called Fred Harvey and the Appetite of America, talking about Fred Harvey from the 1870s until the 1950s, when his corporation finally went belly up, where he serviced with the railroads, hotels, restaurants, things like that. And he brought to them a level of service, a level of quality cuisine, and a level of giving somebody bang for their buck that had never been seen before. The government couldn't get close to it, but he delivered. And mm-hmm. he elevated, and he made the water rise with the level of, in this case, culinary excellence, eloquence, and the ability to feed people at a reasonable fashion, where he was also giving them just plain good food, good lodging, that kind of thing. The government can't even come close to achieving that kind of thing. I've been reading about Ferdinand Porsche and the development of not only the VW bug, but the Porsche cars, things like that, and what caused that to happen. Why did Ferdinand Porsche develop one of the first cars that was successfully an electric car, by the way.
Wow.
Because he put his brain together and he said, you know what? I can make this happen. A guy saw him, said, that young man has talent. At the age of 23, he develops an electric car, and he does it because some smart guy who wants to make money, who has money that Porsche doesn't, says, I'm going to have Porsche on my staff so he can make me money and we can advance the state of the world. That's what the market delivers.
Mm. Preach. You know, if the market delivers so many wonderful things like sliced bread and all different varieties of cars and cell phones, computers, then I think it's about time. You know, we have enough of these gadgets. I want a market for liberty and justice, freedom.
But you know what? If you think about it, we've had that market all along. We just have to convince people to deprogram themselves from the government indoctrination centers that they've been at since they've been 3, 4, 5 years old, and free their minds and point their right finger at the right temple and say, the revolution begins here.
It's been Bill Buepert of ZeroGov.com and Derek J of DerekJ.me. I hope we've calmed the hamster in your brain tonight. Check out more Freedom Fiends at freedomfiends.com. And until next time, remember that everything the state has, it has stolen. Everything the state says is a lie.
Smash the state every day.
Worms.
Worms.